So if the National Gallery gets 400 million, they have to give a percentage to an institution of their choice. Mm-hmm. And it has to change every year.
Das ist What's Next Berlin. Der Podcast, in dem wir herausfinden wollen, wie sich Berlin in der Zukunft weiterentwickeln wird. Wir laden Denkerinnen und Macherinnen ein, die der Gegenwart immer einen Schritt voraus sind, nie stehen bleiben und heute schon an morgen denken. What's Next Berlin erscheint zum Geburtstag des Sony Center am Potsdamer Platz, das vor 20 Jahren auf einem Areal Berlins entstand, das bis zur Wiedervereinigung Deutschlands noch ein absolutes Brachland war. Das Sony Center hat schon damals mit seiner unverkennbaren Architektur und seinem Nutzungskonzept einen Raum für neue Ideen, neues Arbeiten, Wohnen und Unterhaltung geschaffen. Und auch heute kreiert das Sony Center wichtige Impulse für den Wandel der Stadt. Und dem wollen wir auf den Grund gehen. Ich bin Ansgar Oberholz, der Mitgründer vom Sankt Oberholz in Berlin. Wir betreiben Coworking Spaces und Cafés und beraten Unternehmen. Und ich freue mich sehr, in diesem Podcast mit euch zusammen einen Blick in die Zukunft der Hauptstadt zu wagen und zu erfahren, was denken unsere Gäste, muss in Berlin passieren, damit die Stadt auch in 10 Jahren immer noch genauso innovativ ist wie heute. Los geht's mit What's Next Berlin.
Welcome to Kaisersaal. Welcome, Jascha. Nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
If I would meet you accidentally at a party or a gallery,
yep,
and I would ask you while we have a nice drink, what are you doing? What would you answer to me?
I think my answer would be that I'm trying to change the world a little bit in my own way with art or by the use of art or with artists. So I guess in like real terms, I'm a creative city planner. I'm a curator, a cultural agent pretty much. And I just want to use art to change the way we think about society, we approach political or even economical issues, and support the creative community as much as possible. I think that's what I would say. Maybe not.
Yeah, let's dive deeper into that a bit later. But if I get that right, the key to everything and the super tool you're using is art.
Yes.
And what was your first touch point or the reason why you used this tool for transforming cities? I mean, you could use a different tool, but it's art. Why is that?
I honestly believe that one of the reasons why I think art is so wonderfully diverse is because it's not a language. There isn't a barrier. There is a way of having one artwork that speaks to everyone, no matter where you are, no matter how old you are, no matter where you're from, what you do. And that's an enormous power. If I write something, it needs to be translated. If I translate it, something gets lost. If I just display a flower, it remains a flower. And I think that's something that has enormous power. So whatever message I want to bring across, I want to make it accessible to everyone.
But was there this one situation or this one experience you had? When you thought, well, now I need to be involved in art in any case.
It didn't happen like that for me. For me, it was me growing up as a young punk rock skateboarder. I was naturally surrounded by creative people at the time. It was a lot of tattoo artists, a lot of comic artists, a lot of comic writers, a lot of graffiti artists. And there was always this sense of community. There was the sense of you help me, I help you, I give you something. And it was always around art. Somehow always there was an art exhibition or somebody had a new sticker or like all of these things, or somebody finally made it into Comic-Con or something like that. And I realized that I'm not an artist, so I'm not creative, and I wanted to be as close as possible to make even more happen within this community. So I naturally fell into, you know, staying in a creative circle. I started working for a modeling agency in New York. Instead of being a model, I became one of the bookers. Then I got headhunted. Then I became an editor-in-chief for a tattoo magazine. Then I made my own art magazine, my first art magazine. And from there on, it kind of got me even deeper into the creative community. And then I started to listen. And I heard their concerns. And it was always like, I can't get a gallery show. I don't know how to show overseas. I can't afford a studio. All of these concerns. And I thought, what could I do to kind of open doors that would make these concerns somehow not go away, but easier? And I opened my first gallery.
Which was one? That was not the one in Berlin, the Strict 9? No, which one was it?
It was Strict 9 New York.
Ah, okay.
And from there, I then opened. So it was interesting. I had the gallery there with the magazine and everything. And then I started to listen to the people and they were like, oh, but you're from Europe. I would love to go to Europe. And every time I flew back, to Europe, it was like, man, I would love to go to London. I would love to go to New York. And I was like, okay, let's see. And so I opened up another gallery in Berlin and then one in London and kind of started creating networks between those cities for the artists at the time that I worked with. And it was not made with money. We didn't have any money. We were really poor, but it meant in a very beautiful way that we would bring an artist over. And then they would sleep on your couch, and then you would cook dinner together, and you would talk about what you were going to do, and people would come naturally to your house every Tuesday. And so community was built. And that was a big advantage in the end.
But all those galleries were called Strict Nine.
That's
and
correct.
Where does the name come from?
Because I was heavily into goth and, you know, punk, and I needed to be something strong. There was nausea. Nausea is not a good name for a gallery, you know. It's like Buttholes Over is not a good name. But like, it was a component that strychnine is made out of two things, out of two chemical components that separately, they don't do anything. But if you put them together, they become lethal or they become very potent. And I always thought that there's the artist and then there's the gallerist or the agent or the supporter of the arts. And you need to bring them together in order to be potent.
You draw a line between contemporary art and urban contemporary art, obviously. Can you help me to understand that line, and what do you submit beneath urban contemporary art?
There's nothing beneath urban contemporary art.
Or included.
I do, me personally, I don't draw those lines, and I'd rather not have them drawn. But people don't understand often my approach when I say, you know, to me, art is art. There's just different genres. And graffiti isn't street art, and street art isn't urban contemporary art, and urban contemporary art isn't contemporary art, although it is contemporary, but it's a genre. And those lines are drawn by the need of creating cupboards. Everything has to be in a cupboard in the art world as well. There's modern art and it has to be after 1941, and then there's this and there's this. I don't have that. But in order to make it understandable to all communities, also, you know, the traditional art world, that is a name created. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you have urban contemporary art and then you have all the sub-genres.
And you just mentioned already graffitis and tags and whatever. For me as an amateur in art or in urban contemporary art, there isn't a line between street art and graffiti. I mean, just a
there
teenage
is.
Graffiti. But I don't know. I have teenage kids, so I wouldn't say
that. Oh, I hope they're deeply into graffiti.
They do not graffiti. But if they would,
I would
say it's not art.
Okay. But, well, yeah. So the first question in the world is who says what is and isn't art? That's the question that concerns me the most. Like, who decides that? I don't understand it, and I'm still on the search of finding out.
Yeah.
I think the greatest and the biggest difference between graffiti and street art or urban contemporary art is that graffiti is a language. Graffiti is a unique style of handwriting, of type, of creation. It is an identity. It's very specific. While street art in general or urban contemporary art, you know, is... again, mostly something figurative or a text that wants to be read. Graffiti doesn't want to be read. Unless you're part of the culture, you can read it, you can understand it. But if you're not part of the culture, you will consider it vandalism or dirt or whatever. Mm. But as I'm saying it, I'm also, you know, thinking this is only partially true, because at some point, all the street artists that we consider now urban contemporary artists were vandals, you know? So everything is changing and fluid. But I think the most important thing is if you can't read it, if it's a tag or something like that, it is graffiti. And the other genres or portions of it will make it understandable for a broader audience.
Getting back to your history, but you came to Berlin in which year?
I don't remember. I honestly don't remember, but it was in the... in the early 2000s, I would reckon.
And would you say you're rooted here, or you're rooted in various cities, or do you feel like Berlin as your home?
Home is to me where the art is. It sounds cliche, but it is true. Whenever I have a project where I can get creative, then this becomes home. And then I try to get to know the location, the place where I work, and all of this as much as I can to make it my home, so I can truly respect the environment in which I'm about to work, get to know the people, and kind of get a holistic approach on my work. Personally, I spend most of my formative years between London and New York. So I have very strong connections there to this day. But Berlin, to me, is a city that in my adult working life shaped me probably the most.
Would you say Berlin, it was supposed to be a very creative and innovative place?
Yeah.
For sure, let's say in the 90s. I think there's no discussion about that.
Yeah.
Would you say it is still innovative today?
I think there's a dream of what Berlin represents. But I think from the development politically, as well as, you know, economically, I wouldn't think that that spirit of amazing creativity is alive. It's a magnet for creative people who dream of that Berlin.
So you would say Berlin lives more or less from the cliches of this creative place that it was?
A lot of it. Mm. Not all of it, because there's amazing creative people here as well that I absolutely adore and has amazing groups and amazing opportunities if you fight hard for it. Mm. But I think this is really part of the problem, yeah.
And what kind of roadblocks do you see that block the old creativity or the larger or the bolder creativity and the innovation away?
You need to be brave. You need to be brave to allow the creative spirit to blossom. If you decide that it can only blossom if you can control it, nothing creative will ever bloom. Mm-hmm. Creativity needs to be wild and it needs to find its way and it needs it's the responsibility of creativity to find a new way, to question everything in its way. If you do let that happen, you may be very surprised at the outcome. It may be the most wondrous, beautiful thing you've ever seen that happens in front of your eyes. If, however, you want to muzzle it on the way, I think you're doing more harm than good. Because eventually, anybody creative who is muzzled will say, I don't want to do this anymore. You don't listen to me. You want to tell me what to do. You don't support me in ways that it actually is beneficial to me. So I will probably leave.
What is happening at the moment in different ways?
Yeah, in different ways.
Part of the art scene are leaving Berlin.
Well, a big part of the art scene is leaving Berlin. I think if you really look at it, this is quite disconcerting that you lose a large collection. You lose one of the biggest video collection here, an amazing woman who built up this. Julia has done an amazing job. Fashion Week, I think, is gone.
Yeah.
I would watch that very careful and question why.
What do you think? Why do those formats leave?
Well, I think I can tell you why I left and went to New York to build another museum. And I'm very two minds and two hearts about it, because the reason why I think a lot of creative people leave is because they create and create and create and they put all their heart and like everything they have in it. And when it's done, everybody comes and celebrates and gets their piece of, I've always knew this was going to work. But there's a huge gap in the way of getting there. And after it's, you know, opened or had its first major impact, there's almost no interest and support further on.
What you say is that on the one hand, there's especially the more or less grassroots movements needs more support.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, the already established people, formats and places, they need more attention, more respect.
I'm trying to be a bridge between grassroots movements and traditionally established positions. For example, if a city has already, you know, a funding project in place where they give huge amounts of money to an institution as Fördermittel, you know, as supporting financial support, then I think why not implement within the existing structure that, for example, 0.5 or 1% of the money that a large institution receives is going to be allocated to a grassroots institution by that big institution by law. It has to be that way. So if the National Gallery gets 400 million, they have to give a percentage to an institution of their choice. And it has to change every year.
We're here in the Kaisersaal, and even here in the Kaisersaal, a lot of people don't know that, but there are changing art exhibitions. And I mean, the Potsdamer Platz is shaping Berlin in a way. What are your feelings? What do your eyes see when you look at Potsdamer Platz or walk through? Or
when I look at Potsdamer Platz, I don't think of a creative cultural hub. Although I should, because there's a massive amount of history and museums here. But if I ask my friends, or if when I first would I imagine myself first coming here, I would go here for shopping. And it would be a little bit of no man's land. So when I think of Potsdamer Platz, I think probably of an enormous space with enormous potential that needs to find its DNA and figure out where it really wants to go. But people don't have that time to put in a lot of work for just one spot. you know, because they don't see the immediate benefit or, oh, it's another meeting I have to have. But if it happens, I'm telling you, it's magical. Mm-hmm. If it happens and people are on one table and actually try to pull one string and do compromise, mm-hmm. but with the same direction in mind, it can be absolutely marvelous.
There was another, let's say, positive discussion or positive tension 20 years ago when the SUNY Center was created by Helmut Jahn. And Helmut Jahn told us that the people who were in charge were not able to find common ground on the decision for art being involved in the SUNY Center. And then somehow he brought in Jan Kersalé, French light artist, who was already pretty famous in France. And he created this light installation on the roof of SUNY Center, which is still pretty the identity of the SUNY Center at night, I would say. How do you approach this more or less pretty good planned and curated combination of art and architecture, which in opposite to street art, which is not curated in a way or planned, is, from my opinion, a totally different approach to combine architecture and art. How do you see that?
Well, there's a few things. I think any art that isn't carefully curated lacks something. So even the street art projects that I do are curated. So, you know, we're getting very much into the neighborhood, the space, the place. Why do I put something here? Who do I want to put something there and why? And what are we going to develop together in terms of what the actual object of what's going to be put there is? So it's a very fragile, very collaborative effort. So if I work, I don't work with the art. Mm-hmm. I work with creating a platform. So if I would work with the SUNY Center, I would create something that can feature a different sculpture every 3 months, which ultimately, as we all know, has the great benefit in the digital age that a new artist is here, a new name is here, and new people are going to come to see it. But it's natural because you created the platform within the space. So when I think about curating city planning, I don't think about what's there forever. I think about what's there that offers the most opportunity to the space and to the art.
This is a nice definition of curation, I would say.
Yeah. So.
I've read that you follow a principle that you call all nations under one roof. Mm-hmm. And we already talked about holistic approaches and building bridges. But could you give me some more insights on that principle and how you use it and how you... Can you always follow it or do you sometimes have to drop it?
Can I always follow it? I think I work with ideas that I have and I try to stick as close to them as possible. When I built the museum, it was clear to me that it was going to be for everyone, for all nations, for everyone, regardless of age, gender, background. It needed to be a house for everyone. And that's when I thought, this is all nations under one roof. We're going to give a home to all the creatives, no matter where they're from, no matter what age, no matter what gender. This was the idea. And I think I created something beautiful there that actually had that spirit, you know, in the beginning.
And talking about the museum, you mentioned that a few times. Let's spend some minutes on that. That was founded in Berlin as well, right?
Correct.
When was that?
I wrote the concept about 10, now 11 or 12 years ago. And I started the work on it in 2012. And we opened doors in 2017.
And where was that placed?
In Schöneberg.
In Schöneberg. Yeah. Still there.
It's still there. Yeah. I'm not there.
You're not there?
I'm not there.
How does it come that you're not involved anymore?
Out as a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. I think number one for me was about proof of concept. Mm-hmm. I build a museum, I build a residency program, yeah. I build programs around the museum's program, and I set it up for it to work. Mm-hmm. I ran it for the whole 5 years that it was in the making because I already ran projects while we built the museum. We already had projects. And then it was about if it needs me to survive and to run the way it's set up, then I've done something wrong.
Okay. I mean, you mentioned that there is a current project that you tried to establish in Berlin.
Yeah.
And which you didn't really get grasp on, which you do now in New York, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Could you give me more insights on that? So what happened that voided you to do that in Berlin?
Well, I think it was what we...
What kind of project is it?
Well, it's the extension of my work with Urbanation, because I learned so much. I'm so grateful for every support I had along the way to let me pretty much learn by building a museum from scratch. Mm-hmm. You know, we spoke about architecture. I got to work with Graft. I got to work and talk to so many interesting architects and ask them for the right things. I learned about how to make a floor, how to put a light by. I learned about everything by doing.
And this is the project, right?
And this is the
research.
Project.
To do
this
the research
is the
for
research.
That.
Okay. This is the project. The project is to build a museum that is going to be a space of the 21st century. That is almost, that's why I'm so inspired by the Futurium in Berlin as well. So when they opened it, I was like, oh my God, let me be a part of it. I'm dying. This is amazing. I think art, science, and probably, economics. Mm-hmm. They need to have this trifecta, and they need to learn and work with each other. But above it all, around all of this, is the global idea of us becoming better humans for generations to come after us. So as an institution, we have the responsibility to teach people about sustainability, to stand up for certain causes, to really have a voice and be a voice, and not like sit back and say, no. Get in there. You want people to come to you. You want creativity to be in your house. And I want living creativity in my house. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to show creativity of years, centuries, you know, past. Absolutely. But I want it to be lively. And I want what I do to be alive. And I want it to be alive for everybody that comes and chooses to visit me. Mm-hmm. And I want it to be responsible. So it's a progression into what could the future be.
And talking about the future or the future museum, how do you see the role and the impact of digitization and automatization on art and on the museum?
I find it interesting and a great crossroads when robots start to make sculptures. I find it interesting to see when drones paint. But then there's so many facets. You know, if the drone paints what the artist programs or leads, that's one thing. If we develop drones that start thinking individually, which we already have robots that can do that. Mm. The one thing that, you know, separates us from robots, in my opinion, is emotion. And art is emotion, any emotion put on display. So it becomes very interesting if we think that tech becomes emotion, creates art. Is that possible? What not? So that's one thing.
And brings back again the question, could this be art?
Could this be art? Exactly. Yeah. So what is it? And how much is the creator? Who is the creator? And what is the creator? Yeah. And is that, like, all of this is very interesting. I'm fascinated by it. Yeah. I think when it comes to digitalization, we're speaking about a global network. And I think creatives need to be connected globally. They need to be connected globally. They need to understand. They need to travel. They need to see. They need to experience. That's my opinion. And because of that, everything digital has been of a great advantage to the people that I work with, because they very early on started using Instagram and, you know, TikTok and all these things to spread their work out into the world, which also gave them a new sense of, you know, emancipation, because all of a sudden they didn't really need the gallerist anymore to kind of spread their work. As a matter of fact, it's on a big shift now. The galleries need to get the artists that sell for sure, because they come with a huge clientele into their house to survive.
Oh, wow.
Interesting shift. Hmm? Interesting shift.
So they kill the middleman, right?
So that's an interesting shift. Although I do believe we need galleries, because galleries are much more than just money-making machines. They offer opportunity, you know, to show and be face-to-face with art, which I also think it's important. Mm-hmm. But when you ask me about digitalization and digital change within the museum as a body, as an institution, I think it's vital. Mm-hmm. Because I think we're making, youth is learning more and more in school. I don't have any children, but I have, you know, 10 nephews and nieces and about 100 fucking godchildren, which I love. And I see how they learn. For example, in America, my kids there, they learn with computers already. Like in sixth grade, it's all computerized. So I think the mix is about using the digital to go back to the analog. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be an interesting challenge. We need to use digital to inspire, to create analog. Mm-hmm. That's what I would like to do.
I often look at the change of work and the future of work. And I think, yes, we see a lot of remote and decentralized work now.
Yep.
But I think the analog, the brick and mortar world might be not so important in quantity, but in quality. And where do we meet, in which rooms do we meet? And I think especially for art, I would say it's the same. It's yes, you can approach art remotely, but I think it's totally different if you are in the room and meet the people and are in front of the art.
100%.
And it creates an aura.
Yep.
And I think, like, you know, like we had this phase where things needed to be handmade.
Yeah.
And then they were like good. And I think this could be something that happens now that we say, yes, it's okay to approach art remotely, but it's like a real event if I go there and see it. And I mean, I cannot touch it, but I can touch the aura.
I think that's a very important point that you're making. And I think that's something that we, you know, should observe very closely. Like you say, with the workspaces going remote, that's one thing. If I sit in a Zoom meeting for 8 hours and now I have a remote museum, I have a remote visit, my emotional connection to the world, first of all, I probably don't want to look at that museum exhibition that evening because I'm tired from my 8 hours of staring at the screen. So I don't want to do that again for my private time. Yeah. Another screen event, yeah. I probably won't want to do that. Then I'm going to postpone it. By the time I get to it, unless I'm really structured, there's another event. So there's a lot of fluctuation in which events are we actually placing our attention to. And then apart from that, also, it becomes really impacting the market. If you want to talk economics, I put together big collections. So I have clients who send me out and tell me to put their portfolios together. So in a weird way, it sounds very economical, but it's like they want me to put something together that has sustainability, a great life, and is important and relevant art historically. Would you buy something that you haven't seen in person? Would you spend humongous amounts or even just $500 on something that you haven't touched, that you haven't seen? Probably not. And even if you would do it because you're innovative and forward-thinking, there is a great difference between the art world. Like, only you see it, that start as low as the calibration. Mm. What you see as a red here that matches perfectly into your living room comes to you as a pink.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
can you
right.
return
yeah.
it? Because it's yeah. not the color that you've seen it. So we're yeah. entering new legal ways, yeah. new economic ways. And this is, to me, again, fascinating, mm. but also a little bit dangerous. And I couldn't agree more with what you said. The interaction between art, artist, and viewer is something that is and has to be kept alive at all cost.
Do you see current developments and potentials that could be kissed alive, that are not kissed alive? If you think yes, what are the roadblocks for that? How do you feel? Where's Berlin going, city-wise, structure-wise? Not only for the creative scene, but maybe in a bigger picture.
Yeah. I think when I think of Berlin, not being a born and raised Berliner, I think of a lot of change and a lot of little pieces in the city. A lot of places that have their own identity, but they don't belong together. And then I see a lot of places that have no identity because they are still not, had still no chance to figure out their identity after the wall came down. So there's a lot of places that are like in between, mm-hmm. in between. Mm-hmm. And I think what would be fantastic and phenomenal is if people would start paying attention again to the whole picture and slowly but surely not develop new projects to put on something, but to develop projects from what is there. As I said before, you have an empty space like Leipziger Platz, do something with it. Develop the things that are there and spend money on helping to make the things that are there more aware or more beautified or more unified even, than to come up with new great ideas. There really are some great ideas out there, but first fix the base. And get it together, you know, like put your soil down and make sure that soil is fertile and good, and then start building on that. There's a lot to build on. You have water in the city, you have parks in the city, you have empty spaces in the city. We don't need another. Maybe we need something there.
Imagine we could talk to the mayor of Berlin, Michael Müller. Do you think we could convince him, like, let's give us a try for three places or whatever?
Why don't we try? Yeah. I am all up for this. I am ready to go. He has been very supportive to me. Mm-hmm. He has been listening to my ideas a lot, and he's been very perceptive. I don't know if it's only him. You and I would have to talk to, there's a lot of other people. But the thing is, I'm always up for doing this. And I think there should be, instead of spending a lot of money on doing another amazing new thing, let's spend some money on trying to breathe some life and some longevity and some, you know, diversity and some, I don't even know, sustainability into what was created very quickly and now turns out to be some sort of empty failure. Mm-hmm. you know, and there's nothing wrong with it. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody can create something and it just won't run, but the architecture is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. But let's find out why, although the architecture is phenomenal, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So what's missing? What's that little ingredient in the cake mm-hmm. of Berlin that makes that slice, that particular slice, yeah. taste good? And I would be more than happy to do that.
Is it alive? Do you have a place in mind in Berlin where we could do a good prototype?
Several, but as we are sitting here in this beautiful, beautiful space, I mean, look at this place. It's absolutely gorgeous. Nobody knows that this place exists unless you're a Berliner, mm-hmm. unless you look that up. Really, mm-hmm. it is the truth. So that's an empty space. That's gorgeous. So let's figure out how to take a little bit from this to the outside and make it more inviting. I would look at Leipziger Platz. Mm. I would look in front of the Rote Rathaus. Mm. Dear God, oh, yeah. there is so much space in front yeah. of the Rote Rathaus
You're
that
right,
we
yeah.
could create something yeah. unbelievable, beautiful, something organic, something that doesn't just come and go, I'm here. Something mm. that's like, look at us. This is all us. Look at this. And we're ever changing, like society, like the people who come and go to Berlin, like the subject matters that we're dealing with every day. If we could create a platform like those cubes that I've been suggesting, I think I've been suggesting them to them as well in the Rote Rathaus.
remind them.
remind them that these cubes that I want to create that are given as optional spaces, ever changing. To all genres, curated nicely, day and night. So you can't afford a ticket to the Philharmonie? That's fine, because every Thursday, first Thursday of every month, the bass orchestra of the Philharmonie will give an intro of what they're going to do in there, out there.
You hosted last year the Urban Nation Biennale
Correct,
in Berlin.
Yes.
And if I say now you created something like a lab, could you explain us shortly what the Biennale was about? And yes, I say it's a lab. What Berlin could have learned from the Biennale?
When I created it, I again thought of the fact that, you know, certain events don't happen for the people in my genre. So while there is a Venice Biennial, you have to be with a big gallery and get invited, and all of this is a lot of hurdles. And they have a right to be there, and it's a phenomenal event. But I was thinking, for us, there isn't such a thing. And I was thinking that if we can do a biennial, if we can twice every other year come together in a neighborhood, transform a neighborhood completely, give opportunity in the most unexpected places, have challenge everybody involved, because this is a challenge, to rethink how they work and come up at the end with my vision of the end result was that we all learned something in the process, and we all in our own little world created something so amazing with so much struggle and inner challenge and bravery that we would then show the one thing that matters the most to me in life, next to art, the possibility of the impossible, the seemingly impossible. So if you tell people you're going to build the entire breakdown of a planet from a desert to a regrowth jungle, which is essentially what I created over these 150 meters, people will tell you this is not possible. If you then tell them, but I want to do this, knowing that everybody's going to say she's wasting the money on the sand, she's wasting the money on the flowers, if I then tell you, I'm also going to show you that we're going to try to be an entirely green production. Mm-hmm. And we're going to try to, already going in, know that the sand will go to all those dirty sandboxes around Berlin that need new sand. And I will tell you that all the trees will be replanted. And I will tell you that everything we used will be longevity, either in a collection or reused again. Then this will be an enormous experience. And this will now, and now on top of all that, about the visual and the creative, we're going to hopefully inspire you to get to keep that jungle, that nature going. So we asked questions. The Biennale was only about asking, what can we do? What if? So the question that concerns me most is not why not or why or the what if. What if we would though? But what if we do this? So when you work with me, most of the times people say, well, this is not possible because of this. No, it's not possible. And my consistent, what gets on the nerve of people the most is probably that I will say, yeah, but what if we do it that way? Mm-hmm. But what if we try to? But what if? What if? So I'm asking with the biennial, what if every human being had a chance for an education? what would that change be? What if we had ways of preserving water and nature? So it was, I think it was 12 questions and 12 creative positions. And I transformed that space, and it was for free and it was for everyone. And I'm contracted to do it again next year.
Oh, yes. That's really cool.
So I'm hoping that it will happen in whatever form. We have to see what happens. You know, we live in unprecedented times. But I am actually already under signed contract to do it again. And I already have a theme in mind.
Questions in mind.
Questions in mind and things. So it's about being a lab for, you know, the producers on site, the artists on site, very difficult circumstances. It was an expedition on its own.
And what would you say Berlin learned from that event, from that Biennale?
I think how beautiful it is when all those entities that really don't get along and don't want to work together at first sight work together. It took a lot of politicians to work on there. It took a lot of, you know, mayors and city officials to say, okay, I believe in that.
Yeah.
And it took a lot of artists and a lot of producers, and it took a lot of people to kind of be individuals that were brave. And that individual bravery led to a community spirit that when it was done, it was hugely successful because it exuded the beauty of what was created.
Ah, okay. So especially the doing was something that
the
community
doing, the actual accept, not, it's not an acceptance, but the actual idea of this can actually happen was massive. To let it happen, to make it happen was massive. You know, to let that come to pass in Berlin, on Berlin streets, was massive. And then to have the resonance, we had a free newspaper, you know, to get the support for a free newspaper, to have those questions, to be free, to not charge entry for the people of Berlin. And I think in all of its wild craziness, it had this curated structure that made exactly sure what I said before. Crazy is good if you give it room to play and you successfully build a structure around it that allows it to grow and to work. And I think that was accomplished then. I think that hopefully has set the tone for people to go, let's do it again, or let's try something like that.
You just mentioned the Biennale will be back in next year.
Yes.
But last question, if you look into the future of Berlin, the next 10 years, let's imagine we could travel in time 10 years. What do you think Berlin will be like, the city itself, the people, the society? Will it be innovative again?
You know, honestly, if you asked me what I think it will be, I wouldn't be able to answer. But if I was asked what I would hope that it could be again, or what I hope it would be, I would probably answer that I hope that everything we've discussed, from finding the DNA, finding new ways to collaborate more with the existing and the new that's coming up, all of these ideas, that they would actually come to pass. And Berlin would find a way out of just being the crazy party city that, you know, has opportunity but not really, and find a way into being this place of enormous change, of incredible responsibility for the culture, for the people living there, and of incredible innovation. I would hope that this would be possible. And I think we've delivered, you know, two or three mighty good ideas here. So who knows? But that would be my hope. My hope is that it grows together even more. And I think that's what needs to happen. You know, this DNA finding one soul in here. I hope that would be good. And then, of course, if that happens, creative spirit comes back.
Thank you for being here. And that was a really, really inspiring talk. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Bye.
Bye.
Danke für dieses inspirierende Gespräch und den Einblick in die Zukunft unserer Stadt. Das war What's Next Berlin, ein Podcast vom Berliner Sony Center, produziert von Mit Vergnügen. Abonniert den Podcast überall, wo es ihn zu hören gibt, oder bewertet und kommentiert ihn gerne bei Apple. Ich bin gespannt, wie euch der Podcast gefällt. Ich freue mich aufs nächste Mal, wenn wir wieder darüber sprechen werden, was kommt wohl als nächstes auf Berlin zu. Tschüss, macht's gut und bis nächste Woche.